Thanks to the organizers and Field Institute for what promises to be an excellent workshop. And thanks, actually, Kurt got it off to a great start. So bandgap optimization of photonic crystals via semi-definite programming and subspace methods. As in the past, I try and have extremely long titles. So, and actually, this is joint work with a postdoc named Abby Men, a PhD student, Joel Sassone, another postdoc, Kurt Nguyen, Pablo Perillo, who is here, and Jaime Pereira in aeronautics at MIT. And there's two papers on this in, I'm telling you this for a reason, in Journal of Computational Physics and Physical Review E, so which has to do with computation. So as the title might suggest, and the publications might suggest, this is work I don't understand very well. So, and that actually is true in the sense that the optimization I understand, but the physics, I'm going to have to defer to others if you have questions. So, so what's this all about? So, in a sense, here we go. So, I'm looking at these ceiling tiles here. If you look at these ceiling tiles, right, most ceiling tiles, acoustic ceiling tiles, you know, they have these random patterns that are designed to absorb sound. Okay? So now you can imagine, instead of random patterns, you had very specific repeating patterns, sort of periodic, that, and you did it in the right way, that certain sounds would be absorbed and certain others would not be absorbed. Okay? And so apparently all this extends to electromagnetic waves. So at the nano level, if you could design materials, say a dielectric material, literally like a shirt or just or the surface of a wall, all right, with that was periodic at the nano level in just the right way, you can do all sorts of manipulation of electromagnetic waves, all right, stuff that almost sounds like science fiction. So you know you can do. You can do things like, well, I'll get to this shortly, but that's what this is all about. This is all about designing materials at the nano level, okay? And why is it being eigenvalue problems? All right, so that's, in a sense, that's where this is headed, okay? So, and turns out there's an exact 100-year gap between the one-dimensional case and then 2 and 3D. So Rayleigh in 1887 showed that in one dimension that you could in principle design materials so that you could sort of nullify out certain wave spectra, right? And then 100 years later, Yablonovich and John showed that it was possible, at least theoretically, to do this in two dimensions and three dimensions, all right? Sort of that is that, okay? And so here's a picture of a design from a paper by Stephen Johnson up here of sort of a three-dimensional periodic crystal that absorbs certain stuff that's going on. And so how is this useful? And so this also I don't quite get, but apparently by doing this in the right way and by spreading out the eigenvalues between two different bands, say like the third and the fourth eigenvalue of certain systems that arise, you can do things called waveguides. So a waveguide is like a why am I blanking here? But fiber optics. So are waveguides, okay? So hyperlens are things that can be used to or what sometimes they're called super lenses that allow you to see images greatly magnified. In fact, magnified beyond what the theory tells you they can be magnified at. Resonant cavities, switches, splitters, I don't know. All my colleagues elsewhere in engineering at MIT tells me that these are very important, fairly fundamental problems. So, and so that is that, okay? And so, for example, I'm just going to show you a solution to one of these problems. So here's a photonic crystal with an optimized seventh band gap. Okay, so we're going to design a, and this is periodic. All right, so this would just go off in all dimensions. And these are two different materials. Typically, sort of air is white, and then the black is gallium arsenide. So this comes out of an optimization model, and the optimization model is actually trying to spread out what's called the relative band gap. Before I get to relative band gap, let me just tell you the band gap. So that is, as you go around the in the wave domain from something called, I love this, the irreducible Brillouin zone, okay, which I'm perhaps pronouncing correctly, which can be parameterized as a triangle, sort of going from gamma to X to M and back to gamma, as you go around the edge of this triangle, and you look at an infinite dimensional system of equations, and you compute the eigenvalues, and we want. So for each point here along the boundary, there's an eigenvalue system, and we want to design this material so that in the resulting eigenvalue system, okay, the difference between the seventh and the eighth eigenvalue is maximized simultaneously. And so here in color are all the different eigenvalues, and notice for every point along that triangle, I mean, I realize you don't know the correspondence, and I barely know it myself, this has been optimized. So the relative band gap is 44.12%, for example. Okay. So that's a solution to this problem. So how we're going to get there is another story, okay, or is what this talk is all about. Okay. And so generically, sort of in a sense, here's what's going on. So you want to, it says here, exploit linearity and periodicity to formulate Maxwell's equations as an infinite dimensional eigenvalue problem. So we have over here is our material, okay? And we're going to let for each point in our material domain, we will assign a value epsilon of r, where so r is the point literally in space here. That's the dielectric function, which will vary with the spatial position. So for example, here it's 0, here it's 1, etc., but it could also take fractional values, although we don't want it to take fractional values. Okay, but it's already too complicated to solve. Making it a binary integer program is ludicrous, in a sense, computationally, and often unnecessary. All right. So for this dielectric function, epsilon of r, that tells us what our material is going to look like. As a result of that, we get a system of equations here for each as a function of that function, and then k is all points sitting on this domain. So actually k is not, I mean, we're used to in the optimization world thinking of k as an index, but you should think of it as it's just going around here, okay? And so you get an eigenvalue system, and that's, in a sense, lambda of epsilon k is going to be the eigenvector coming out of that, an infinite dimensional eigenvector. K is a parameterization of the wave vector varying in this Brillouin zone, which is also pictured right over here. Okay, so that's sort of it, okay? Keep believing me, and then the optimization problem is what's called to optimize the gap-mid-gap ratio between, say, the mth and the m plus first eigenvalue, okay? And this is the notation that people in physics and various parts of engineering sort of use for this, which is, so imagine here's our dielectric function, okay? We get our eigenvalues, and our objective function is to maximize, well, so I want the smallest, as I go around the Brillouin zone, the smallest value of the m plus first eigenvalue minus the largest value of the mth eigenvalue. And then to normalize it, we would sort of divide by the average, which is just going to be, say, the sum over divided by 2. So I'm going to get rid of the 2.
Okay.
Yes. R is position. So at the moment, this is two-dimensional photonic crystal design. So that where we're going next with this is three dimensions. Okay. But we haven't gotten there yet. I mean in our research project, not in this talk. Okay. All right. So for example, here's a dielectric function, and then you solve for the eigenvalues, and for this particular configuration of the dielectric, we get a nice gap between the second and the third eigenvalues that's consistent throughout. Okay, so that's the optimization problem there. So we want to find an optimal dielectric distribution that maximizes the gap-mid-gap ratio. So in a sense, that's the whole problem. So which is, one can imagine, truly nasty. Right, it's infinite dimensional, it's infinite scale, it's non-convex, and badly conditioned, because it's going to optimum are generally going to occur, for example, where eigenvalues line up. So you lose differentiation and all sorts of other stuff like that. Okay, so but that is sort of the problem, but. Apparently, it's an important problem, so you want to try and figure out how to solve it anyway. So that is that. So what has previous work on this done? So because this is, people have worked on this a lot. So there are some approaches based on solving the band gap optimization problem. So Cox and Dobson considered the problem and proposed some kind of projected generalized gradient ascent method. Okay. So, but, and there, so what are you going to use for gradients? Well, sort of you build a local model of the eigenvalue as a function of your variables. Okay, and so that's dangerous when you get multiplicities. Okay, so that's a, these problems have limited success. Sigmund and Jensen combine what's called topology optimization with something called the method of moving asymptotes. So I don't know if people in this room have worked on the method of moving asymptotes, but a lot of these methods I've looked up and have read, and they seem what I would call sort of fairly heuristic methods to do simple optimization that sort of happen to work on the class of problems that someone was looking at. Okay, I mean, mind you, we perhaps can accuse people in our field of doing the same, and perhaps ourselves as well, but they're rather ad hoc methods. And then Kao, Stan Osher, and Yablonovich used sort of something called the level set method, which is not what we in optimization think of as the level set method. All these methods, however, are gradient-based. They use eigenvalues as explicit functions, and so they run into problems with regularity due to eigenvalue multiplicity. Okay. So what do we do? So eventually, we decided to replace the original eigenvalue system by something called the subspace method, which I'll get to, and then we convert, and probably convert is not the right word here. I would sort of say convert slash approximate, okay, because it's not like we found some magical trick that was going to turn this into a convex problem. It's more like, you know, just about in everything you do, including, say, basic Newton's method, right? Newton's method, in a sense, is based on the linearization of a quadratic term. Okay, you're linearizing somewhere in life, and so where you're choosing to linearize or where you're choosing to convexify, and we tried several different schemes. And let me just outline one scheme which didn't work, so I actually don't have slides on it, but just to give you an idea of sort of how you can be sort of clever on this. So just imagine, for example, for a given place on the for a given value of the Brillouin zone, I got a bunch of eigenvalues here, and I got a bunch of eigenvalues here, and I'm trying to spread these out. Okay, so right, nonlinear, non-convex, a mess. Okay, all right. So now suppose I, instead of working with my original matrix, I work with its inverse. okay? And this is actually an idea due to someone sitting on the right over there, okay? So suppose I work with the inverse here, all right? So if I work with the inverse, so and I subtract off stuff so that now here is at the origin, okay? All right? So this is the smallest positive eigenvalue, which in the inverse becomes the largest positive eigenvalue. And this is the largest negative eigenvalue, which in the inverse becomes the most negative eigenvalue. And then to try and to shrink that distance, okay, that's a nice convex SDP, typically, all right? But, of course, in the approximation using the inverse of the matrix as opposed to the original matrix, and how good is that? So actually, we thought this would work great, but it didn't work so great as some other stuff. So, I mean, we were really trying a whole bunch of different things. So, Pablo, with apologies to you for that idea, okay? Which is, I mean, actually, we were very excited about that, but computationally, it was not as effective as some other stuff that we came up with. Okay, so let's look at the mechanics of some of this. So some of this is fairly standard, what's done on these types of problems. So one is, instead of looking at this as looking at every point here on the boundary of the Brillouin zone, we discretize. Okay, so that's standard. You know, there's nothing novel there. And then we discretize our material space so that you can sort of think we're working with pixels, right, as opposed to that. So we have a, we take our space here, we pixelate it, and we just assume that's just a piecewise constant, and it's going to be always sit between some lower bound and some upper bound in each pixel. Okay, and the lower bound is going to correspond to this dielectric constant for air, and the other for gallium arsenide is the typical application. And then the number of pixels might be huge, but we'll worry about that later. Okay, but that now this is just think of this as some giant hypercube. Okay, and that's kind of nice because right hypercubes have a lot of structure, so we know what they look like. It's not just some old polytope. Okay. And then you use something called the finite element method, which probably a lot of you know what it is. I do not. to obtain these discrete approximations of this differential equation system. And now instead of an identity matrix here, we have a mass matrix. So this is winds up being a generalized eigenvalue problem, but that's no big deal. Okay. So right, as a function of my dielectric, now my dielectric function, so instead of epsilon of r, it's just a bunch of different values of epsilon for each pixel, and then for each of these, say, red points on the Brillouin zone, I have a, I have this matrix here, and then I have my mass matrix, and then I can collect my eigenvalues and eigenvectors any old time I want. I mean, computationally intense, we'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is what's called the Hermitian stiffness matrix, and this is a positive definite mass matrix. Okay, so that is that. And then here, in a sense, is after the discretization, this is what we would call sort of an exact formulation of the discretized version of the problem. So it says, right, I want to maximize, we could sort of think that's that's my bound on the, say, the m plus first eigenvalue, and this is a lower bound on that, and then this is an upper bound on the mth eigenvalue divided by their sum for having a relative band gap. And again, these guys have to, each of these values, so these are two variables, okay, that this is an upper bound on the mth, this is a lower bound on the m plus first for all those different systems. And then here's the way physicists and engineers tend to write this down, right? These are not, in a sense, constraints in the problem per se. They're just sort of identifying that, right, this is the eigenvector corresponding to the mth eigenvalue for each of these k systems. Again, k is going around the discrete points in here, and this is the m plus first eigenvalue. Things have to sit in my hypercube. My eigenvalues better be positive. Okay, so that's it. And I should point out these matrices here are sparse and banded, which is useful, that the number of points around the Brillouin zone, which tells me in a sense how many of these different eigenvalue systems we have, sits between 10 and 20, so think of it as like 15, okay? The number of pixels we're considering typically is between 200 and 500, all right? So that's, in a sense, that's the true design variables in the problem, okay? And these stiffness and mass matrices are on the order of 2,000 by 2,000 to 4,000 by 4,000. So large, okay? But again, sparse and banded. Right? So that's sort of the problem, okay? And then to make things a little more exotic, that there's two different ways that one can set up to conceptualize the problem, or there's two different, and I'll just tell you what this is all about. It depends on what's called two different kinds of polarizations. There's, I guess, transverse electric polarization and transverse magnetic polarization. And I don't know what those are, okay? But they are different, and so you might want to spread out, get a band gap for the eigenvalues in transverse electric mode or in transverse magnetic mode or both. Of course, now, both had never been done before, but we were able to do that, which is coming up, okay? But also say that it turns out after you do the discretization, and then this is just getting used to a little what I would call sort of boring but useful notation, okay? So in transverse electric polarization, the stiffness matrix is, by the time you discretize, it's actually, it's linear in the reciprocal of the values of the materials, okay? So that's kind of convenient, right? Because if I have to sit in a hypercube, so I can just redefine my variables to be one over this, and then it's a different hypercube. Because if I've got my upper and lower bounds are not zero and one, they're both positive numbers. So I just take the reciprocals and everything works out. And then that's for electric mode. And then the mass matrix actually is independent of the variables, and so everything works out. Okay, for TM polarization, you wind up with the stiffness matrix is actually independent of the values of the material, but the mass matrix is linear in things. So everything works out by just routine observation and manipulation of the variables. Okay, except when you want to do both. So if you want to do both transverse electric and transverse magnetic at the same time, right? I need this variable. I need whatever my new representation for this to be the inverse of what I've got here. Okay, and we just use Newton's method and linearize. It's amazing how well it works out. So we're a little bit astounded by that actually, and so. Now for convenience, because I've got, occasionally I'm working with reciprocals, and then this is going to be my upper and lower bounds on the gaps for the two eigenvalues of interest, and then for TM polarization, so I'll just call this whole vector thing my Y vector, so now these are my variables, okay? For TM polarization, I'm going to call everything my Z vector, and these are my variables, and it turns out here, I actually want to work with the reciprocals of the eigenvalues, okay? But it's because it's just arithmetic, okay? Nothing deep going on, believe me, okay? And so let me just show you, for example, the transverse electric case, all right? After you do that, you wind up, in a sense, with this problem, okay? So here's my objective function. So now it's my Y vector. So the first n epsilon components of it are actually the epsilons. The last two are the upper and the lower bounds on the two different eigenvalues, okay? And so this is the last one and the next to last one. My bounds on the eigenvalues are here. The eigenvalues in there eigenvectors are here, and now I've got to sit perhaps in a new hypercube, et cetera. It's exact. This is non-convex. It's large scale. And so we tried this. We tried several other things. And I'll just tell you what we wound up using that actually worked. And let me just see. So I can sort of try and show you in space. Yeah. So in a sense, let me try and just show. I'm also looking at the time. Oh, we're good. Okay. Right, if I want to separate, I'll just write it this way, okay, in a sense. So if I want to look at the, actually I should use this, AU equals, right, lambda I, or lambda MU for the mass matrix here, all right? So if I'm looking at eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this system, right, so I can have, here's my kth one here, okay, and I want to particularly call out, I want to look at, say, the seventh and the eighth, okay, and I want to spread those out, okay, I can think of, all right, so I've got, right, I decompose everything in terms of the eigenspace. I've got two orthogonal eigenspaces. One is corresponding to the first seven eigenvalues and their eigenvectors. And everything up there, so in that subspace, if I hit this matrix from the left and the right by that subspace, I've got some phi transpose A phi, okay, that this has to be, so if it's the first seven, this has to be less than or equal to, call it lambda seven. I got to hit this with that too. Okay, so I wind up with, now this is a semi-definite inclusion, okay? And then for the eighth and beyond, I look at that eigenspace, and let's call that phi bar, just because, and then that's going to have to be bigger than or equal to lambda 8 phi bar m phi bar, okay, all right? So if my matrix A and my matrix M are functions of my decision variables, okay, so this is correct, you might think, okay, well, how come people haven't done this already, okay? I've taken what this non-convex problem turned into a convex problem. Well, I haven't, right? Because the thing is, if A was a linear function of my variables, so these eigenspaces are a function of the variables. Okay, all right? But in a sense, so that's where we do the approximation, where we pick a point, okay, and we fix the subspaces locally and sort of keep our fingers crossed and hope that's a reasonable, keeping those subspaces fixed as opposed to moving around with the decision variables is going to work. And it did, okay, pretty well. All right, so that's what I've got here. So for a given y hat, I could just think of my eigenvalues and my eigenvectors as a function of a given value of my decision variables at a given point on the boundary of the Brillouin zone, and then I introduce these two matrices, sort of, well, I call them phi and phi bar here. They're actually sort of phi L and phi U for the lower eigenvectors and the upper eigenvectors, okay, of the system, okay, and then the condition that my eigenvalues have to sit, say, between the seventh and the eighth, I can just write down as nice semi-definite inclusions, right? This is non-linear now because these spaces here are varying as a function of y, but then we approximate them and we fix them at a y hat, okay, and so, you know, trying all the tricks we can, okay? For instance, that trick that I outlined earlier didn't work so well. This one tended to work very well, okay? But it's still problematic in the sense that, okay, now I've got these inclusions. Suppose I want to separate the seventh from the eighth, okay? So this guy, then, by the time you're done building it, okay, this is a 7x7 system, okay? But if I've got, say, 4,000, I think this is now 3,993 by 3,993, okay? And I can see Kim Chuan getting worried. with that. And so the next thing we do, in a sense, is a version of an active set method. Okay, so why worry about all the eigenvalue, all the eigenvectors? Let's worry about the ones that are whose eigenvalues are close to the current ones that are tight, right? So again, I tend to think of it like this. Here's my gap. I got a bunch of eigenvalues up here. I got a bunch of eigenvalues down here. I might have multiplicities right here. Right? Multiplicities don't scare me here. All right? That was sort of, in a sense, the beauty of this when it was first actually shown to me by others on the team, and was that, right, instead of keeping track of eigenvalues, we're keeping track of eigenvalues. We're keeping track of eigenspaces. Okay. Now, mind you, there's other problems associated with that, but we're conceptualizing things with keeping what's going on in these two orthogonal spaces, having that work well. Okay. And then when we're doing that, we're sort of thinking, okay, so I have up here, I have 3,000 of these guys. Okay. Well, let's just pick 7 or 8 of them. Okay. And then down here, sort of similar, although I'm usually going to have very few of these to begin with. Okay. So that's what we do. So we reduce the size by considering sort of only the important eigenvalues, okay? So like sort of A of them at the for the lowers and B of them for the uppers, and these are typically chosen sort of between 3 and 7 with a heuristic that was worked out by others on our team that, again, after tons of fine-tuning, sort of works reasonably well, okay? So now the approximate problem is a linear fractional, it's a linear fractional SDP, because we fixed the eigenspaces, okay, here. And now these matrices, right, in here, these guys were huge, but out here, these guys are the smaller dimensions. So, and I've got, you know, 10 to 20, say, 7 by 7 systems. It turns out most of the work was literally in building the SDP, not so much work in solving the SDP. All right. So this problem has sort of significantly smaller semi-definite inclusions than if the full subspaces were used. And it's a linear fractional SDP, and you all know that, you know, I can convert a linear fractional problem to an SDP, a linear fractional conic problem to a conic problem. No problem there. All right. So that's that. And then sort of our algorithm is just what you might expect it to be, which is start with an initial guess and some positive tolerance, and then for each point in the Brewin zone, get the subspace of the appropriate dimensions, compute the subspaces, form our convex SDP, we solve it to get a new solution. If the new solution is close to the old solution, we stop. Okay. So I should point out, right, this is, you know, this algorithm is sort of like, you know, sort of violates most publication criteria for math programming. We're not going to prove convergence, okay? In fact, I'm sure does it converge, you know, if it stops, what does that tell us, et cetera, et cetera. But it tends to do reasonably well, okay? And much better than anything that's been out there to date. But go ahead, Kurt. Right. That's right. That's right. Yes. And so there was some fine tuning. And this is not like, to a certain extent, I'm a little pleasantly surprised at how well it worked. Okay. So that it was, and mind you, there's a lot of effort went into various versions of this. So this is not like, okay, huh, we tried it and worked and didn't give any further thought to it. Okay. This is not the case. Okay. And we use SDPT3 to solve it. And so let me give you some examples, okay, of solutions. So for example, here in transverse electric mode, optimizing the gap between the second and the third eigenvalue, you get sort of these, we call these things wallpapers because for appropriate reasons. So this is sort of what it looks like. You know, is this a true optimum? We don't know. Is it a true local optimum? In a sense, we don't know. We suspect that we try different starting points, we get different solutions. And I'll show you some of that later, to indicate that we know we're only getting local optima, and at times we get very unlucky and just have to restart everything. Okay. So that's in transverse electric polarization. Here's transverse magnetic polarization for the second and third eigenvalue. You get a different wallpaper. And you might ask yourself, how can you build this? Even if you lived in a two-dimensional world, because these things just have to sit in space. Okay. And so I'll get to that later. Okay. Because right, we can't build this. Okay. And the three-dimensional version would be just these sort of balls sitting in space. All right. So give you some idea of execution times and problem complexity. So for transverse electric mode, that seems to be a little harder to solve. So, and as the band gaps, as you seek sort of deeper and deeper band gaps, so between the first and the second eigenvalues, the average execution time was about 1.3 minutes. Average number of outer iterations of the method, right? The SDPs solve, you know, that's always been very predictable, like 9, then it sort of, this grows, gets like 13, 14, 15 once you get higher eigenvalues. And likewise, execution time goes up as well, okay? For TM polarization, it's an easier problem. I don't think it's well understood why it's an easier problem, okay? But sort of it starts out being much easier and sort of, in a sense, stays that way, all right? I should also point out, coming back here, that we're not observing any gray here. So gray would mean that the values of our dielectric is sitting in the interior of the hypercube, okay? And so that is completely not understood, okay? Why all these methods tend to get you the corner points of the hypercube, okay? But it's, I would say, a huge sigh of relief, as one could imagine, okay? But, I mean, that's sort of, and we don't know what to do about that, and many others don't know what to do about that, but at the moment, I would say, are enjoying the fact that we don't need to do anything about it, okay? The other thing that sort of says is that, you know, this is a relatively fine mesh to get this, and one sort of thing, you know, do you really need to start with a fine mesh? Maybe you could use what's called mesh adaptivity, which is sort of a standard thing, and so we built that in, and so you start with a coarse mesh, and then you want to double the you want to increase the refinement of the mesh where you need it, okay? And there's various rules for doing that, and I won't bore you with them, but one can imagine, I mean, this is sort of fairly routine kind of stuff, okay? We built that in, and that speeds things up by a factor of like 30 to 200%, okay? So which becomes useful is because the problem that I've shown you, I'm going to make it even more complicated very shortly, okay? And so this is the same old algorithm, which is either we stop when we're really close or we stop when we're really close and when our refinement level is sufficiently fine. That's all, okay? And now I'm going to try, see if I can, sort of show you a movie of this. So here, for example, is optimizing the gap between the second and third in transverse electric mode, and we start with this coarse grid. And so you can see the grid is, here's the grid. Okay, and then there's the solution. All right, so the grid is staying very coarser, sort of, you know, away from the boundaries of various objects. Okay, and you wind up with the wallpaper that I showed you a couple of slides earlier. And for transverse magnetic mode, it's simple too. And so, I think it's almost done, or maybe it is done. Yeah. So. That is that. And then here's some stuff on execution times, so what the savings winds up being. So the savings ratio, you know, this is savings, this is like 280%. This is just 40% down here. This is, it sort of changes all over the place. So, but one would expect, kind of duh, you know, that if you do an intelligent mesh adaptivity, you ought to do well. Okay. All right. So Then, as it turns out, what about multiple band gaps? So in certain applications, one wants to not just, say, separate, get a good relative band gap between the second and third, but also simultaneously the second and third, maybe the fifth and the sixth, stuff like that. I don't quite understand, again, the context for it, but this was a completely vexing problem. No one knew how to tackle this, okay, but, right, using the machinery of what we know how to do with constraints and everything else, this sort of becomes relatively routine, okay? The only difference really is that if you think when you wind up having these linear fractional programs, you know if you have a linear fractional objective, we can convert that. If I have, in a sense, if I want to maximize the minimum of two or more linear fractional objectives, we can't do that. We can't convert that directly to a conic optimization problem. Okay? So what do? Well, we linearize and we take linearizations, and that all seems to work rather well. I won't go into all the details, but in a sense, here's the constraint that says, let me ignore this W term. This is just, think of WJ as one, okay? So this says I want to maximize the minimum of all these different gaps, okay? This is, F is a variable, this denominator is a variable, there's two variables, so is the numerator, clear the denominator, linearize, and go to town, okay? And we just do that, okay? And you modify your algorithm appropriately, and I'll show you some results. But actually, before I do, let me go back to the start and explain to you these weights. So think of these weights being one, okay, which says I want to maximize the smallest of all these relative gaps. Okay, when the weights are not one, and in almost no, when the weights are not one, it just sort of says some gaps are going to be more important than others. Okay, and you might sort of think, well, that's, who cares about that? And at one level, we don't care about that, but to illustrate what's going on with local optima, that becomes very useful. So let me just show you some computational results. So for example, here we simultaneously compute the second and fifth band gaps. So second band gap is between the second and third, fifth band gap is between fifth and sixth. I haven't shown you these because the things work out particularly well. I mean, we just solved zillions of these, we just picked some at random. Okay, so this is not an engineered presentation that way. All right, so you start with a relatively coarse mesh, and you do more mesh adaptivity. Whoops, and by the time you're done, you wind up down here, and you've opened up. Here's your second to third, and here's your fifth to sixth, and they're both at the 18%. And here's the resulting wallpaper, looks like that. Okay, and but. Sometimes when you solve these, you get different answers than other times. And here it is in TE polarization, the first and the third band gaps. So you get TE polarization, and then you can also use this to work with simultaneously transverse electric and transverse magnetic. And apparently, this had never been done before. So people did not know how to do this. So in a sense, this was like the first ever time you're able to open up a band gap between both in transverse electric and magnetic modes, and it looked, and here's the resulting wallpaper, looked like this. Okay. However, there's something funny going on in all of this. Remember I said sometimes the problem would work, you'd give it a different starting point and it might get a completely different solution. Okay, and so we played with these weights to sort of illustrate this, and so you have to let me explain to you what's going on in this. But this is actually showing that, right, this problem doesn't always work so magnificently, okay, as follows. So, for example, if I started out with, I give it equal weights, okay, and I solve it, and maybe I get, and so this is the, what's called the first relative band gap, or the first objective, and this is the second objective, which winds up being, I believe, it's the first and the third band gap. But I've got two different things I'm weighting differently. Okay, you can wind up, say, with this solution here, which I'm calling point B. Okay, and there's the wallpaper. Okay, so if you start with that, now you just tweak the problem by changing the weight. Okay, you generate, say, and if I keep tweaking, I generate this frontier of points in the blue crosses. Okay. And so this wallpaper morphs to this up here. So again, this corresponds to, this corresponds to putting much more weight on this second objective and much less weight on this first objective. Okay. And then I can move it down here, and I wind up with this wallpaper down here at point D. Okay. All right. But that was starting from one particular solution. If I start elsewhere, I generate different paths. And so another realization, and then when you play with the weights, you wind up with this path here going down. Here was one of them. Okay. And so clearly, we're getting a lot of local optimum, right? All these solutions in here are inferior to ones that would appear to be on the Pareto frontier, although for all we know, there's other solutions way out there that we've not picked up. Okay. So that is that this is to sort of show you that, yeah, we're getting local optima. Some are better than others. And so sometimes we have to solve the problem multiple times from different starting points and pick the best one. Okay. So and here's some stuff on execution time. I'm seeing I have 10 minutes. So I want to talk about where we're going, but on a particular domain called what's called fabrication or implementation robustness. So one place that this work is going is in three-dimensional photonic crystals, where the problem is much, much harder. That is, this Brillouin zone is like a simplex, and so the number of points you have to choose on it, be on the boundary of it, it winds up being a mess. Okay, everything winds up being much, much more complex. Okay, but we feel the need to sort of go there. Okay, because typically, if we're ever going to fabricate it, we'll fabricate 3D versions of it. Obviously, I want to talk about robust fabrication, and I think I'm not going to. And then all this is other stuff that is more for the engineers and physicists. Okay, so here are two of the structures that came up in previous slides. Right, so here is one of them, which was disconnected. Okay, so you could sort of think, well, maybe we'll just, and these are called, I just abbreviate this, PCs, photonic crystal designs. So, right, this can't be fabricated because it's not connected. Okay, so this structure here, even if I eliminate these points in the middle of each of these, okay, this is not going to be so easily fabricated either because the boundary is so complicated. Okay. So one could imagine, okay, so, you know, I'll add connectivity constraints. I'll solve the problem. If it's not connected, I'll put in some cuts, okay? And, you know, that, in a sense, would work, except it won't, right? Because, I mean, it's the problem will quickly become hopeless. Likewise, I could have some curvature constraints here, you know, designed to sort of, but again, the number of such constraints would be just, you know, unfathomably large, okay, in what's already a difficult problem. Okay, you know, so in a sense, what do? So you're like, you take this problem here. So here's literally what one could do. So solve the problem, okay, and instead of, here I state here, right, the connectivity constraint cuts or boundary smoothing constraint cuts, you know, that's out. Instead, sort of do this stuff by hand. Take a solution, all right, if it's not connected, connect it. Okay, intelligently, but literally sort of user involved. Okay, all right. So, you know, if we connect it with very fine rods, or maybe coarser rods, or even coarser rods, et cetera, and of course the quality then of the gap would seriously be degraded. Okay, and you could sort of look at all of that. Okay, and so here is this is the thickness of the connectors between them, and here are the two different band gaps. Because this was for this was a wallpaper corresponding to optimizing simultaneously, maximizing the minimum of two relative gaps. Okay, so it started out at each at 34.9%. Since we want to maximize the minimum, it's the minimum of these two we're worried about. And after a while, of course, it seriously degrades. Okay, but it also suggests if you're going to do that, let's. There's a lot of other domains in optimization, and I don't want to get too hand-wavy about this, but right, there's a lot of optimization problems out there where we know in advance we are not going to implement exactly what comes out of the model. Okay, so just think of solving a portfolio optimization problem, a real one, okay, and people are going to want to round to even lots. You know, and they're not going to buy 454.73 shares of Microsoft or Google, right? So, you know, but you don't want to put in integer constraints, okay? So if you know in advance, so there's another situation, you know, one can imagine an engineering problem where it says, okay, we want to, you know, have the thickness of this plate be such and such, but your machine won't allow the fine tolerances that are coming out of the optimization model. You know you're going to be able to do something nearby, all right? And so for that, we've come up with this notion of what's called fabrication robustness. This is different in spirit from what we know as sort of robust optimization, because there, that's data uncertainty. Here, it's implementation uncertainty, okay? So very different. We'll assume here our data is perfect, in fact, okay? All right. So here's a general optimization problem, right? Optimize some nice convex function over a convex feasible region, okay? And again, I say we can't necessarily implement the optimum because often we've deliberately simplified the model to keep it tractable like we have here. We're not going to put in connectivity constraints, okay? Human factors or technological or economic factors, whatever, okay? So let's sort of say, suppose we anticipate that any solution can be easily converted to something that can be implemented or fabricated in this case, okay, that's nearby. So, and the thing we're working with, for example, is we'll sort of say, okay, we know that by changing 50 pixels or less, we anticipate that by changing 50 pixels or less, we'll be able to connect our structure. If we know that in advance, instead of optimizing our original function, why don't we sort of think conservatively and define a new function, which is sort of what's called the fabrication robust counterpart, which would be the worst of all values over all y's that are nearby. Okay? And again, delta is a parameter. You could think of it as a confidence parameter or something. And the norm is some suitable norm, which you can imagine for the hypercube lends itself. We're going to use a one norm or an infinity norm or a mixture, and I don't have time to talk about that, and people are probably eager for lunch anyway. But then our new problem becomes, instead of minimizing the original function, we want to minimize the robust counterpart, okay, taking that structure into account. So I'll just tell you, on the one hand, this is not very good because f tilde will not necessarily be convex, even if f is convex. However, if the domain is all of Rn, okay, and f is convex, its robust counterpart is convex. If f is quasi-convex, its robust counterpart is quasi-convex, okay? Computing the robust counterpart is, in a sense, what I would call generically intractable, okay, because it involves the maximization of a convex function over a domain. However, there's lots of structure that one can take advantage of to actually, you know, compute it in lots of relevant cases, and I'll just tease you with one of them. So, for example, suppose our function is piecewise linear convex. It's the maximum of a bunch of linear functions, okay? Then it's easy to show that the robust counterpart is the maximum of these linear functions, where, in a sense, all I've done is change the constant term and replaced it by delta times the dual norm of the norm that I have assigned to the original problem, okay? So here, the robust counterpart, okay, for this specific structure sort of retains all the computational ease, okay, that one had for the original function, okay? And we're working on stuff like this for in our next phase of this research. So, and I think I'm done. Thank you very much.